Hey guys, before you listen to this one, do realize this is part 4 of a series about General Kanji Ishiwara. So if you're not already done so, I would recommend listening to parts 1, 2, and 3. This episode is General Kanji Ishiwara Part 4, Ishiwara vs. Hideki Tojo. So I promised this would be the last one, and it is, rest assured. Sheesh, what a start to a suggested episode which turned into an entire series. But then again, Ishiwara Kanji was quite a figure. I recently did a podcast interview with Cody from Alternate History Hub, and at the end of the podcast, he poked at me looking for some alternate history ideas related to the Pacific War. My first thought was about the triple intervention after the Russo-Japanese War. What if it never occurred? But then I thought, hell, what if Ishiwara Kanji never existed or, I don't know, was hit by a car? Imagine how different things would have been if not for this one, I'm just going to say it, instigator. Now, I think when one looks at this man's life, we attribute much of the story towards the Mukden incident and the eventual full-scale China War. But that's not where it ends, of course. Ishiwara did a lot during the Pacific War and after. So to close it all up, let's jump right back into it. Ishiwara is now a major general, chief of the most powerful office on the general staff. He was fighting tooth and nail to limit operations in what was then being called the new North China War. A month before everything hit the fan, he declared in front of the general staff, "I shall never send a single soldier to China as long as I live." But by mid-June of 1973, rumors emerged that the China garrison was planning another incident in the Beijing area, similar to Ishiwara's famous Mukden incident in September of 1931. 2 weeks later, the Marco Polo Bridge incident occurred on July the 7th. The Japanese army were divided on the issue. There was the expansionists, who sought to smash China in a single blow, and the non-expansionists, who sought to settle everything between their nations before the conflict became too large. Ishiwara was on the side of the non-expansionists, and from the earliest hours of the war, he directed a losing fight to try and localize the conflict. Fight as he did to stop mobilization of further forces, he was forced to relent multiple times, and to his horror, the conflict grew more and more. Ishiwara's efforts, or some would say meddling, ironically made things worse for the non-expansionists. Some of the expansionists would go on the record to state Ishiwara bungled the entire situation. Years after the China incident, Colonel Shibayama would say this with some bitterness. "The idea that Ishiwara Kanji exposed the expansion of the China incident is nonsense. If he really had opposed it, he wouldn't have agreed to mobilization. There were certainly other ways of solving the problem." Ishiwara was stuck between a rock and a hard place. While he wanted to stop the mobilization of more forces to China, the men at the front kept sending reports that Japanese citizens were under threat in areas like Beijing. His wrists were turned, as they say. Ishiwara did not cave in without a fight, of course. As I said in the last episode, he turned to Prime Minister Kanoi to strike a deal with Chiang Kai-shek, and Kanoi nearly did, but at the last minute he canceled his flight to Nanking. When the North China incident saw action spring up in Shanghai, it then became officially the China incident, and Ishiwara attempted once more to push for a peace settlement in September. However, by that point, Ishiwara's influence had dropped considerably. Few in the operations division were still following his lead. Many of the expansionists began to bemoan Ishiwara as nothing more than a mere nuisance. Prince Sanji would go on the record telling Kanoi, "Ishiwara is like a candle in the wind, ready to be snuffed out at any moment." By late September, Ishiwara was removed from the general staff by General Tada. The expansionists had won the day. There were other non-expansionists like Horiba Kazuo and Imai Takio who carried on fighting the non-expansionist cause. But in January of 1838, Kanoi declared the Japanese government would not treat with Chiang Kai-shek. It was basically the nail in the coffin. The war escalated. By 1938, 24 divisions were tossed into China. In 1939, it would be 34 bogged down. The IGA was without mobilization divisions and less than half the ammunition necessary for the 15 divisions assigned to the borders with the USSR. And that critical weakness became only too apparent with two border clashes in 1938 and 1939. To Ishiwara, it was all too predictable. He had continuously argued the folly of a China war. He lectured about how it was impossible to conquer China, stating things like this. China is like an earthworm. Cut it in two and it will still keep on wriggling. Ishiwara believed China's territory and self-sufficiency built upon its masses would always make up for Japanese military might. Ishiwara, unlike his colleagues, believed Japan was not capable of dealing a knockout blow against China. He would criticize many for promoting the idea, stating, "Those who excite the public by claims of victory, just because the army has captured some out-of-the-way little area, do so only to conceal their own incompetence, as they squander the nation's power in an unjustified war." In the fall of 1937, Ishiwara found himself back in mainland Asia, with an appointment as the Vice Chief of Staff of the Kwantung Army. But he came back with a scarred reputation now, for his non-expansionist fight earned him quite a lot of scorn. All of his ideas of political independence and racial equality in Manchukuo in 1932 had all but disappeared. The Japanese military and civilians occupied all important positions in the puppet state. The Kwantung Army authorities, particularly that of Hideki Tojo, who was at the time a provost marshal in Manchuria, had taken a stern line against any efforts to revive the East Asian League or their ideas. So when Ishiwara arrived, he quickly realized his influence had diminished significantly. Nonetheless, he took up his old cause, trying to work with the barely relevant Concordia Association. But they were fighting against Tojo, who received a promotion to Chief of Staff in Manchuria in March. Tojo was now Ishiwara's superior. It was a hopeless cause, but Ishiwara persisted. Ishiwara began insisting the Kwantung Army must step aside to allow for self-government and reign over Manchuria. He argued Japan's special holdings in Manchuria should be turned over to the Manchukuo government, and that the Concordia Association should be acting as a guiding source. He also pointed out how dangerous the USSR was to Manchuria, and that Japan must increase its forces in the border areas of Manchuria. For all of this, he recommended a solution would be a Asian Union, that if Manchukuo flourished under racial equality and harmony, perhaps it would show the rest of China that cooperation was possible, and maybe China would join an East Asian League. Ishiwara would continuously hammer the idea that the solution to the China War was to create an effective East Asian League. With China in the fold, they would have unrivaled air power, a prime element in his preparation for the final war. Not a single one of his arguments were ever given any consideration at this time. Alongside his radical ideas, Ishiwara also advised reducing salaries for Japanese officials in Manchuria, and as you can imagine, he was denounced quite quickly by his colleagues for that one. Then Ishiwara found out Hideki Tojo was embezzling Kwantung Army funds to the Officers' Wives Club, a pet project of Mrs. Tojo. So Ishiwara went ahead by pointing out Tojo's corruption and added a large insult by suggesting Tojo had the mentality of a mere sergeant. In a public speech at the Concordia Association in front of a mixed Japanese-Manchurian audience, he tore into many of his colleagues like General Hashimoto Toranosuke, who was an honorary president of said association, and Ishiwara said this. "He did nothing but sit around and draw a high salary, setting a disgraceful example to junior officers." So yeah, Ishiwara soon found himself very, very isolated in the Kwantung Army staff. Tojo received a promotion to Vice Minister of War in May of 1938, with the support of notable expansionist types. As for Ishiwara, he had become quite a headache to his colleagues. Depressed and disgusted with the situation, Ishiwara decided to quit the army before he was tossed out. He first tried to apply at the War Ministry to be placed on the reserve list, but he was told that the matter required approval of the Minister of War. At that time, it was actually his old buddy Itagaki Seishiro who was Minister of War. While the decision was being made, Ishiwara was authorized to return to Japan. But when he did, the Kwangdong army insisted he had departed without authorization to do so, basically arguing he just walked away from his desk one day. Itagaki made no move to summon Ishiwara once he was back in Tokyo, but Tojo, acting as Vice Minister of War, got wind of the situation and was all too eager to pounce upon it. It turned out Tojo had Kenpei Tai officers watching Ishiwara and some of his closest colleagues for quite some time now, and he chose this moment to haul Ishiwara up for some military indiscipline. The case against Ishiwara was quite a controversy, and in the end, all Itagaki could do for his old colleague was get him a command over the Matsuro Fortress area on Japan's sea coast of Kyoto Prefecture. The day before the orders were posted, Tojo managed to toss one last punch at Ishiwara. He ordered his Kenpei Tai friend, Special Service Commander Colonel Otani Kejiro, to carry out a lightning-fast raid on the Tokyo offices of the Concordia Association, which saw the arrests of some of Ishiwara's closest colleagues. 1939 to 1941 marked a terrible time for Ishiwara's military career, but he did take the time to build more so upon his final war theory, the National Defense State, the Showa Restoration, and the East Asia League. Ishiwara's lackluster Maizuru assignment was quite a backwater, not demanding much attention. During his leisure time, he came to the conclusion, based on his analysis of military history, with some fresh readings of Buddhist texts, that the final war was destined to break out within the next 40 years or so. On March the 10th of 1939, he made an address to the Concordia Association in Tokyo. Sekai Sensokan, a concept of world war. He stated, based on his analysis, that Japan had to prepare for the final war because world conflict is now in the semi-final round, and it is for this reason that the necessity has arrived for an East Asian League. In August of 1939, Itagaki resigned as war minister to take up the position on the chief of staff in the China Expeditionary Army, which was then grinding to a halt. But before he did so, he made one of his final acts as war minister to give Ishiwara command of the 16th Reserve Division in Kyoto. It was not a frontline position, but it was an important one, as the Kyoto Command was notable for developing infantry tactics. Japan had just received some major defeats to the USSR at the Battle of Lake Kasan and at Khalkhin Gol, so Ishiwara went to work developing some anti-Soviet tactics. This led to some infiltration techniques that would see application with the IGA during the early battles of the Pacific War. But despite his work on tactics, what really consumed his mind and time was pressing for the East Asian League. He argued a Showa restoration needed to happen, like the Meiji restoration, but this new one would be pan-Asian, to face the West. In May of 1940, he put all of his arguments together in a public address that gained fame under the title On the Final War. It was here he unleashed two decades of his thoughts into the Japanese public. He added some new features to his theories, such as the world has entered a second industrial revolution. What he was referring to was that Germany had been pioneering in the field of electrochemistry, producing energy for both industrial production and weapons of war. Such discoveries, he argued, would permit Asian nations to catch up and eventually overtake the West in production and destructive power. But above all else, he kept hammering the necessity for an East Asian League, which required a Showa restoration to finally bring Pan-Asianism. In November of 1939, as a successor to the Concordia Association, the Association for the East Asian League was established with its HQ in Tokyo. Ishiwara was unable to officially become a member because he was part of the military, but he was an unofficial advisor, and more importantly, in the eyes of the public, he was the association itself. By 1941, the association blew up to 100,000 members, mostly ex-soldiers, businessmen, journalists, farmers, and such. They had a monthly magazine, training courses, meetings, lectures, the works. They extensively studied Ishiwara's writings on the history of war, the Showa Restoration, and his final war theory. They spent extensive resources securing bases on the Asian mainland, trying to recruit supporters amongst other Asian peoples to create a federation. Within Japanese-controlled portions of China, they propagated the concept of the East Asian League. For the small group of collaborationists in China, many were attracted to it. In February of 1941, the General China Assembly for the East Asian League was established in Nanjing with Wang Jingwei as chairman. Oh, Wang Jingwei. I've spent so much time learning about the Warlord Era and the Northern Expedition, and it never surprises me that this guy would cling to anything for power. The influence of the League even found its way to Chongqing. Chiang Kai-shek allegedly declared that peace negotiations could be pursued based on some aspects of the movement. But come spring of 1941, all of the League's efforts would be dashed by Tojo. In early 1941, Tojo, as war minister, began plotting against the League and its architect, Ishiwara. Tojo believed the East Asian League was very defeatist and antithetical to his own hardline stance on the Sino-Japanese relations. It also provided his nemesis, Ishiwara, with a political base to generate public opposition to his government's policies. Tojo obviously thought Ishiwara would use such a thing to overthrow him, so he went to war. His first move was to put Ishiwara on the retired list in December of 1940. However, Ishiwara was still an influential figure, and he held some considerably powerful friends like Prince Higashikuni. Thus, he was unable to safely pull this off, at this time at least. Instead, he chose to harass the League. Initially, Premier Kanoi was backing the League, but Tojo began to pressure Kanoi to take a position against it. On January the 14th, the Kanoi cabinet stated, "As it appears that they violate respect for the nation and cast a shadow on the imperial authority, theories advocating leagues of states are hereby not permitted." Thus, basically, the East Asian League became illegal. Taking the cue on the cabinet's decision, the Japanese media also began running hit pieces on the League, kind of like how America works today. Shots fired. By February of 1941, the criticism towards the League was smashing them. All of Ishiwara's allies within the League were hit quite hard. Some were actually even tortured by the Kenpeitai. It was basically a purge. For Ishiwara, nothing really happened, except for the continual surveillance by the Kenpeitai. Ishiwara proceeded to vent his wrath in public speeches, pretty bold-ass move if you ask me, and he delivered one fiery one at Kyoto University on the East Asia problems, where he told his audience, "The enemy is not the Chinese people, but rather certain Japanese. It is particularly Tojo Hideki and Imezu Yoshijiro, who, armed and pursuing their own ambition, are the enemy of Japan. As disturbers of the peace, they are the enemies of the world. They should be arrested and executed." Excuse my French, but the fucking balls on this guy. Ishiwara made this statement in public, and at the time he was still in military service. It's simply incredible he did not suffer horrible punishments after slandering the Minister of War and the commander of the Kwangtung Army. Why was he not punished? Well, again, it was awkward, as he still had this cult following and going after him might see some violence. I mean, Tojo literally thought people would rebel. Ishiwara would later state the reason he was not persecuted was because, "Tojo was a coward who never had the courage to arrest me. The fact that a man like Tojo and his henchmen came to power was one reason for Japan's downfall." Regardless, Ishiwara's public statements finally led to him being placed on the retirement list on March the 1st of 1941, and yes, it was 100% Tojo who pushed for this. Tojo ordered the Kenpeitai to watch Ishiwara closely for weeks after his forced retirement. Ishiwara enthusiastically went into his own retirement, as now he was fully dedicated to his four great concerns: the East Asian League, the Showa Restoration, the National Defense State, and of course his final war theory. In the meantime, another league had opened up: the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, and you would be forgiven to believe it was simply the same thing as the East Asian League, basically its successor. Both perpetuated common ideology, like racial harmony, stemming from the Concordia Association. Ishiwada's concepts of national defense also found their way in the greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. It advocated for most of the basic principles of the League: common defense, political independence, and integration of economic systems. How did they differ, you might ask? Well, Ishiwada's East Asian League did not share the former's racial superiority of the Japanese as a core component. The East Asian League was not built upon the premise that China was completely incompetent as a modern state and needed to be led. For you American listeners, it's actually kind of easy to visualize it as basically Japan's Monroe Doctrine. The East Asian League had been completely undone by the China War, and then the Pacific War, leaving the co-prosperity sphere idea to monopolize the Asian continent, and it did so through brute force and a hell of a lot of racism, completely undermining any chance of Pan-Asianism. Ishiwada sought the East Asian League solely because he truly believed Pan-Asianism would be required to build up enough forces to fight the final war. During his retirement, Ishiwada went on lecturing in major universities, but Tojo unleashed the Kenpeitai upon him, who often demanded he either cancel a lecture or not talk about certain subjects. Again, very much like America today. I guess it's also kind of like YouTube today. Though ever the more isolated, when the Pacific War kicked off, Ishiwada could not be fully muzzled. He did not oppose the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor publicly, but privately he predicted Japan had begun a war it would most certainly lose, based solely on material terms. Ishiwada famously said to Satomi Kishio a certain passage. It actually shows up in this kooky little anime called Zipang, which has what I would only call one of the most bizarre premises. The story is basically some SDF members accidentally go back in time to June the 4th of 1942, and they speak to Ishiwada. But not to go down that rabbit hole, here is the passage. "Inevitably, we shall lose this war. It will be a struggle in which Japan, even though it has only 1,000 yen in its pocket, plans to spend 10,000, while the United States has 100,000 yen, but only needs to spend 10,000. We simply cannot last. Japan started this war without considering its resources beforehand." The only reason I bring up this passage is simply because I love it. It's an excellent way to speak to the general public. It was very effective, I find. Ishiwada criticized the military for spreading themselves out too thinly in the early months of the war, dispersing countless men on small islands in the Pacific. But above all else, he kept hammering the fact the China War needed to end. China was sucking up the vast majority of Japan's military resources and men. How could Japan hope to wage a war against a nation like the United States when it was still stuck in China? When Saipan fell in 1944, Ishiwada said all hope was lost. He believed the only possible way Japan could avoid disaster was if the USSR broke its pact with its allies and offered a settlement to Japan. But he certainly knew that was a long shot given how anti-communist Japan was. I have to make a point here and say that a lot of Ishiwada's talk comes post-war, and it feels a lot like a "I told you so" kind of thing. Ishiwada gave testimony at the Tokyo War Crime Trials, and he declared, "Despite its material inferiority, Japan did not need to suffer a defeat if its strategy had been well planned and carried out." He even made a remark to an American correspondent named Mark Gain in 1946, stating if he had held command of the forces, he would have ended the war with China, consolidated Japanese defensive lines, and made a proper stand. Throughout the war, Ishiwada battled Tojo, often referring to him as a simpleton. In fact, in late 1942, he arranged an audience with Tojo, and he told him to his face that he was too incompetent to run the nation or wage a war, and that he should simply step down. Again, the balls on this guy. There was a rumor Ishiwara was part of a plot to assassinate Tojo in the summer of 1944. This was a scheme hatched by some junior officers in the Central HQ, and one of their members was indeed part of the East Asian League Association. Ishiwara was called upon to Tokyo during an investigation of the plot, and as much as Tojo and his team tried to find evidence of his involvement, they were unable to nail him. The Kanpei-tai would be chasing after Ishiwara until Tojo's regime finally collapsed. By the end of the war, Ishiwara was asked by Prince Higashikuni if he could join the Surrender Cabinet as an advisor, and Ishiwara declined on the grounds he did not want to be sullied by Japan's defeat. It should be noted again, Ishiwara was a man of countless contradictions. While he was one of the first to be outspoken against the Pacific War and predicted Japan's defeat, during the end half of the war, he got really caught up in the war fever. For example, in 1944, he began stating Japan needed to prepare to, quote, shed the blood of a million lives in the South Seas in a do-or-die battle. He also had this blind faith that a German victory in Europe would turn the tide of war in the East. He said of Hitler in 1944, he is the greatest hero in Europe since Napoleon. Some argue his later public stances were the result of him not being in the military, and thus he had to conform to the wartime propaganda to get his message across to the general public. He also began linking concepts of the East Asian League to the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, which is quite the contradiction. Again, personally, I've always seen him as a bit of a fence-sitter. He loved to always have a backdoor in his arguments. One major thing he faced during the Pacific War was trying to explain to his followers the current war was not the final war. As he stated publicly in February of 1942, many people think that the Greater East Asian War is the final war. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Greater East Asian War is the grand rehearsal for the final war. In other words, it will lead to the liberation of East Asia and the establishment of a East Asian League, and it will provide the League the necessary materials and strategic base for the final war. Well, the failure of the China War, Pacific War, the complete military collapse of Japan, the takeover of communism in mainland Asia, and the emerging Cold War, I guess all of that kind of ruined his final war theory. With Japan's defeat looming in 1944, Ishiwara began to shift his focus towards a reconstruction effort. He began as early as 1944 to talk about what would happen to Japan after. He predicted she would lose much of her overseas territory, her cities would be in ruins, her people would be starving. He turned his attention to agriculture. How could food production be increased? He became particularly interested in the field of fertilizers. By the end of the war, he gathered a farming community to discuss how things could be improved. When the surrender proclamation was made, he began to ponder the meaning of his life's work. After the emperor made his speech, Ishiwara gathered his followers to speak to them about how Japan could regain world power and thus keep his theory intact. Ishiwara had many ideas going forward about how Japan could take a positive footing. He advocated Japan to dismantle the remnants of its bureaucratic despotism, abolish the special police force, apologize to the global community for its war crimes, but he also argued America needed to answer for her war crimes as well. He especially pointed fingers at President Truman for the firebomb campaign and the two atomic bombs. He argued that the two bombs should lessen Japan's punishment. Ishiwara also argued Japan should gain sympathy from Asia, so that their former enemies could all come together to form an East Asian League. Emperor Hirohito proclaimed the surrender and abolition of all stocks of war materials, and Ishiwara said that was just fine, because he believed the final war would require new armaments that would be completely different from what currently existed. He predicted the future wars would be more scientific, fought with decisive weapons developed in laboratories that did not require large organized military forces. He thought perhaps a small body of underground scientists could create terrible new weapons to prepare for the final war, and that is a terrifying idea. In autumn of 1945, Ishiwara found himself in the limelight again. His lectures had made him a viable alternative to the Tojo regime during the last year of the war, and his reputation as a opponent and victim of said regime made him kind of special. Many journalists, both Japanese and American, came flooding to him, followed by a legion of followers who were unable to publicly come forward during the Tojo years. Ishiwa took advantage of this new situation to make some very large speeches. He spoke about how the Tojo clique was the reason for Japan's defeat, how all they needed to do was to establish a new Japan. He brought out the usual theories that he had been speaking about for years, and he argued the necessity for national reconstruction to prepare for the final war. However, he changed his argument a bit, stating while Japan had militarily been crushed, it now must prepare for the final war by building the highest culture. In this new age, Japan needed to obtain supremacy in the fields of science, because he now believed that was the new power. A single laboratory, a single factory, or perhaps a single man working alone will make the most fantastic discovery that will make war decisive. He would continue to make speeches throughout 1945, but come 1946, the higher authority, one Emperor Douglas MacArthur, I had to say it, I'm sorry. General Douglas MacArthur stamped down any Japanese leader, especially former military leaders. So Ishiwara had a few months of fame, but then he found himself yet again purged, though not arrested. Alongside this came a ban on the East Asian League Association. Ishiwara was then incapacitated by illness, something that had plagued him his entire life. His condition became so bad he required surgery in Tokyo. In April of 1946, he was interviewed by American correspondent Mark Gain, who left with a very memorable impression of the man. He had this to say. Ishiwara received us in a small room, whose window frames were still buckled from the bomb explosions. He is a lean man with a deeply tanned face, close-shaven head, and hard, unblinking eyes. He was sitting Japanese style on his cot, his hands in his lap. Even in a shapeless gown of yellow silk, his body looked straight as a steel rod. We asked Ishiwara just two questions. What of Japan in defeat, and what of himself? He answered readily, and at length, in a sharp, firm voice. He talked like a man who believed every word he said. Ishiwara told his life story. The Mukden incident, the China War escalation, his feud with Tojo, and all of his failed attempts with the East Asian League. In 1947, Ishiwara was put on a list of those Japanese who were purged from all public life. He was extremely bitter about this, and at the same time he was called up as a defense witness in the Tokyo War Crimes trial. Ishiwara was too sick to travel to Tokyo, so a special military court was convened in Sakata City. He made his deposition in front of 50 people, talking about his role in the Mukden incident and the China War. He also stated President Truman should be indicted for the atomic bombs and the firebombing campaign, and he turned upon his American audience about the denunciation for Japanese expansionism. Here is some of what he said. Haven't you heard of Perry? Don't you know anything about your country's history? Tokugawa Japan believed in isolation. It didn't want to have anything to do with other countries. It had its doors locked tightly. Then along came Perry from your country in his black ships to open those doors. He aimed his big guns at Japan and warned that, if you don't deal with us, look out for these. Open your doors and negotiate with other countries too. And then when Japan did open its doors and tried dealing with other countries, it learned that all those countries were a fearfully aggressive lot. And so for its own defense, it took your country as its teacher and set about learning how to be aggressive. You might say we became your disciples. Why don't you subpoena Perry from the other world and try him as a war criminal? In November of 1948, Ishiwara declared on a home-recorded video, "We must utterly cast war aside. We must firmly avoid questions of interest and advantage and judge our national policy purely on a spirit of righteousness. Japan may be devastated, but we must live by a complete rejection of war. The nation must compose itself like Nichiren at Takenoguchi, or Christ on his way to the crucifixion. It seems Ishiwada at the very end gave up on his theories, and he supported Japan attaining a permanent peace. The last years of his life were spent in constant pain due to his illness. In 1949, he contracted a fatal case of pneumonia, and realizing he was going to die, he dictated a message that summed up all of his speculation in the recent years on Japan and its future. The document was originally done in English and directed at General Douglas MacArthur. A month after Ishiwada's death, a Japanese version came out titled Shinnihon no Shinra, The Course for a New Japan. The primary purpose of the document was to get General Douglas MacArthur to lift the ban on the East Asian League, but it was also a last apology. He talked about how Germany, the USSR, Italy, and Japan had started on the path of state control, and they all fell prey to group despotism, because all decisions were being made by a few men in the center. He argued Britain's socialist government, the United States New Deal, and the Marshall Plan were great examples of good control systems. He argued pure liberalism no longer existed anywhere, not even in the United States. Yet, the United States was trying to make Japan a liberal nation. He argued all nations should be allowed to move ahead freely. And to end all of this, he said this as well. I realize now in my predictions concerning a final war between the East and West, I was supremely overconfident and that the facts have proven me wrong. I fear that the real final conflict may be the United States and the USSR. At the age of 61, Ishiwada died in August of 1949 in a small house with some of his followers gathered around him. He said to them before dying, he was glad to die at the same age as Nichiren. And so ends the life of Ishiwada, a man of many contradictions who, I would say, changed history multiple times. I really hope you like this series, and do remember, it was originally supposed to be a single episode based on, you know, one poll question I asked one of my patrons. It was a hell of a lot of fun making this one, and this has been the Pacific War Channel, over and out.